It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll hear from both sides on the city of Waukesha's proposal to divert water from Lake Michigan. And we want to know what you think. Let us know at 800-642-1234. And we're going to go to Wisconsin Life now. This is a story about the river in Wisconsin.
As a child, I was taught that a river was the lifeline of an area. It fed its residents, allowed travel and trade, and provided recreation. This was the book learning. But as I grew up, I heard, saw, and felt the stories of a river. The Fox River begins in Columbia County and meanders north to the Bay of Green Bay. It has separated towns, creating rivalries. Think East and West Apeer, one town, two school districts separated by a current of water. The Fox has been ridden on, dived into, floated upon, argued over, and dumped into. The river hums stories of change from year to year. From childhood to young adulthood, I saw the seagulls and ducks solidly standing on the rock precipices below the dam. Then, in the 1990s, I saw a strange black bird with an orange throat pouch and a sleek, long, curved neck. The cormorants had returned to our area as the river flowed cleaner, the fish multiplying. The birds welcomed me to their story as I drove across the bridge, skimming the water so low, so graceful. Those black birds spoke of cleaner water, of progress from Rachel Carson's warning in Silent Spring, and from the PCBs from paper mills that maimed, killed, and silenced birds and reptiles. Still, the river, the wandering minstrel, created additional tales. Around 2000, another bird, white with black-tipped wings, a large beak pouch, prehistoric-looking, rode the updrafts above the river. On land, these awkward-looking birds stood casually on the rocks below the dam. My husband told me they were pelicans. I'd only seen them at the Milwaukee Zoo. They waddled along clumsily on the cement walkways, looking strange and absurd. But watching the pelicans ascend over the river, I'd stand mesmerized. They flew high overhead in a V formation along the Fox. Sometimes, through the summer months, I saw them soar miles inland, not searching for food, but feeling the warm summer wind, riding the currents, wheeling, gliding. I'd pull my car to the roadside, step out amongst the periwinkle chicory to watch them circle, white upon a deep blue, a slow-spinning, cirrus-feathered cloud. We may learn the facts from a book, but riding along or on a river gives us a chance to see and feel a story that feeds our desire for beauty and awe. It gives us a tale of what was, what is, and what may be possible if we only listen to its words.
Chris Cerucci is a retired teacher, writer, and poet in De Pere. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. A Brewers minor league player made baseball history this weekend when he became the first active player affiliated with a major league organization to come out publicly as gay. His name is David Denson, and he plays for the Helena Brewers, a rookie affiliate of the Milwaukee franchise. He came out to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel after talking to his teammates and his parents. The Brewers responded with his statement. David is a highly respected member of the Milwaukee Brewers family, and he's a very courageous young man. Our goal for David is to help develop him into a major league player, just as it is for any player in our system, and we'll continue to support him in every way as he chases that dream. This comes shortly after Michael Sam, the first openly gay player to be drafted into the NFL, announced that he's stepping away from professional football due to mental health concerns. Here with us now is Sid Ziegler, co-founder of Outsports.com. Sid, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what does David Dunson's announcement mean for Major League Baseball?
You know, it's just it's so interesting. We at Outsports, we've written about, 200 to 300 LGBT athletes who've come out to their teams over the last 15 years, and every single one of them says the same exact thing, that they were scared because they had been told for so long that sports isn't a place for gay people, but that when they found the courage to come out to their teammates and their coaches, they were embraced and treated exactly the same, if not better, than before they came out. And I think David's announcement offers a look into professional baseball, and yet still another confirmation that sports is not a desperately homophobic institution, that athletes are not inherently homophobic, and that people, particularly in their late teens and 20s, like most minor league baseball players are more than willing to embrace an athlete who's gay.
And David Dunson had said he was struggling with his performance as a baseball player, and he thought that not coming out was getting in the way of his career. And following his coming out publicly, his career has improved. His baseball has improved. Is there a case to be made that the coming out publicly can help the athlete?
Of course. You know, we hear all the time about how the media spins this story that an athlete coming out can be a, quote, distraction to the team. But the biggest distraction that hurts the team is an athlete staying in the closet and having to deal with the internal struggle and having to hear some of the what we call casual homophobia that gets tossed around the locker room. That is, when guys don't think that a gay person is around it, that someone will get hurt by it, they'll use this language that they've learned since they were little leaguers. But when a teammate comes out, they quickly get rid of that language because they don't actually want to hurt anyone and don't actually have these homophobic ideas. So it's not a surprise at all that given the change in environment and given the change in his mental space that he would start performing well immediately.
And what about potential benefits for other gay people or athletes who haven't come out who might be gay?
I think, again, it shows another example of an athlete coming out and being embraced. And I hope that LGBT athletes who are stuck in the closet out of fear see all of the stories that have come out and see the incredible support that every single one of them talks about from their teammates and knows that if they come out to their teammates, they are not going to just be roundly rejected. I mean, I suppose there might be a team or two in the United States somewhere where that would happen, but the vast, vast majority of teams and athletes are so ready to embrace a gay teammate.
And are there more challenges associated with the actual team, maybe the teammates and the coaches, or more with society at large when it comes to this kind of thing?
Honestly, I think the problem is the coaches at the youth level and the media. The coaches at the youth level create this environment. They get told, or they create and perpetuate this environment that is not inclusive of LGBT people, using anti-gay slurs and allowing that kind of language and allowing that kind of heterosexist environment to pervade sports. So as soon as young boys enter sports in Little League or Pee Wee League, they get taught this stuff about the environment of sports. And then the media continues to perpetuate this idea that all of sports is desperately homophobic. If you were able to change the actions of just the media and youth coaches, you would transform the environment tomorrow. But regardless of all of that, if every single LGBT athlete came out tomorrow, everything would change. But unfortunately, so many of them continue to be stuck in the closet out of fear.
Why are there so few openly gay athletes in a country where the Supreme Court just legalized same-sex marriage?
Again, it's that fear, that being told from a very young age that you don't belong in sports. You're told it by your coaches and the media. And that's it. I mean, it's just this nonsense. They just wrote a story on Outsports, the 12 reasons you are willfully ignorant if you still believe that male athletes are homophobic. And I just used 12 examples of athletes coming out in Montana and Oklahoma and Virginia and South Carolina and Texas at Catholic schools who are embraced by their teammates. So at this point, if you still believe that athletes or your teammates are inherently homophobic, you are willfully ignorant of the truth.
Now, Michael Sam, the first openly gay player to be drafted into the NFL, announced last week that he's stepping away from football. He was citing mental health concerns there. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like and how it might be different in any way from David Denson's?
Well, no coming out, I think. And maybe when Ellen DeGeneres came out, whatever that 20 years ago, you could point to something that was similar to Michael Sam, the incredible attention and reaction that Michael experienced and has experienced for the last 18 months. I think it was a lot, and you know, I think there are lots of things that have happened over that time, lots of twists and turns and left hand turns, and you know, it's tough to put my head around, because if Michael hadn't come out as gay, he would be in the NFL right now. But you know, Michael is also, I think if X, Y, and Z hadn't happened, he would be in the CFL right now, even being gay. So I think it's a tough story, and I think you are dealing with mental health issues, which complicates the matter.
Sid, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That was Sid Ziegler, co-founder of Outsports.com, talking about David Denson, a minor league player with the Brewers franchise who came out publicly as gay this weekend. He's the first active player affiliated with a major league organization to come out publicly. We're looking at Scott Walker's position favoring a move of power from the federal level to the state and the local level. Here's a quote from Governor Walker given at a meeting with the group American Legislative Exchange Council in San Diego back in July. Governor Walker said, "I'm for taking the power out of Washington and putting it in the hands of the hardworking taxpayers in states all across America. I know it can work. It's worked in our state. When you send power back to the local level, the level closest to the people is generally the best." Our next guest took a look at that position on shifting power to local levels to see how it lined up with on-the-ground policy in Wisconsin during Walker's time as governor. Jason Stein joins us now. He's the Capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin. Jason, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Veronica. Thank you.
Well, Jason, we just heard that quote there from Governor Walker, using language that calls for ceding power from the federal level to the state or the community level of government. Looking at his record in Wisconsin, what have you seen?
Well, you're absolutely right that the governor does talk about that on the campaign trail for the White House. I'm down today covering him at the Iowa State Fair in Des Moines. And, you know, he talked about that message again here today. But when you look at what Walker has done as the governor of Wisconsin, you know, it's more complicated. It's a mix of cases where he provided more flexibility to local officials, but in other cases where he tied their hands and imposed some state-level policies.
Well, if you look at Act 10, that's the governor's signature legislation repealing the collective bargaining rights for most public employees and allowing officials to make decisions about their employees. The governor argued that it gave greater economic flexibility to those local officials. Looking at that case, does it seem like this is the case of the policy fitting the rhetoric?
Well, that's absolutely a signature policy. And in many ways, it did give local officials more flexibility in how they dealt with their employees, both in terms of what they paid them and gave them in benefits, but also it gave them flexibility with work rules and things like that, whereas in the past, those things had been limited by union contracts. At the same time, there were also things that even Act 10 said local officials couldn't do. It prevented them from doing collective bargaining with their employees on their union employees on anything except a certain slice of wages, and it, you know, it did not allow them to bargain on other areas such as workplace safety or health benefits for most public employees.
And you did a survey of other policies there. Give us a rundown a little bit here, Jason. What did you find?
Yeah, absolutely. So Walker and lawmakers have also set limits on what tax and spending increases school boards and local officials, mayors, and city councils can pass. They preempted Milwaukee's residency rules for its public employees. Those rules have been pretty popular in Milwaukee, and they dated back to 1938. So that law was actually reinstated last month by a state appeals court. But that decision is likely to go all the way up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And then just one more example, Walker and lawmakers voided the paid sick leave law or ordinance that was passed by Milwaukee voters in a referendum.
Now, given some of the examples that you just gave us there and what you say in your piece, that the governor may be inclined to do this in the case of people who, regions that may be more liberal, is that fair to say?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a good question, but certainly it's been the case that with a Republican legislature, Governor Walker has looked at some of the things that local officials in liberal parts of Wisconsin, like Dane County or the city of Milwaukee, they've looked at some of the things that those local elected officials did or were going to do, and they said, hey, you know, we don't agree with that. We're not going to let you do that. So, you know, it's an open question about, with a Republican Congress, would a President Walker leave a liberal state, like, say, Massachusetts? Would he let them pursue health care or some other policies in the exact way that they wanted to do that, or would he attempt to put some boundaries on that? I mean, it's an open question.
And can you argue, as some Republicans have, that policies that seem to take away the power from local officials are put into place to create a more cohesive state government in this case?
Sure. I mean, I think in governing, there's always this tension, right, between giving local officials the ability to and the freedom to pursue what their constituents want. There's always a tension between that and having a real balkanized system of government where you have, you know, one minimum wage in one community, another minimum wage in another community, and where, you know, a large-scale business that works across, around a state or across state lines may find it difficult or burdensome to work in that area. But, you know, certainly Scott Walker so far has not been afraid to preempt local officials when he feels it's in the interest of the public.
And what is your overall takeaway then, looking at his track record? As you say, it's not a black and white thing, but does Governor Walker put policies empowering local governments in place?
Here's the thing. I would say most of the time, the party that's in the minority is a far greater supporter of local rights and local control than the party that's in the majority. And I think that's true whether you're talking about Madison, Wisconsin, or Washington, D.C.
Now, you are at the Iowa State Fair right now, if I have it right.
I sure am. I just left there. I did not get a pork chop on a stick. The line was just incredible, and I needed to do this interview. But I am there. I was there, and we had good weather.
And you've been tracking Governor Walker as he continues on the campaign trail. What have you seen so far, and what have his stops been like?
You know, one thing that I thought was very interesting today was the way he interacted with demonstrators and with protesters. I really think they're, in some ways, his secret weapon. He was booed at points during his speech, and he responded that to one protester. He said, "I am not going to be intimidated by you, sir, or by anyone else out there. I'm going to fight for the American people." And clearly the conservatives in the crowd just ate that up, that they saw that as a sign of his authenticity as a conservative and his willingness to stick up for Republican principles. So in a way, the demonstrators of the governor's policies are like his comrades in arms on the campaign trail in this weird way.
Now, as you've been following him, we're in the post-debate time. That was a couple of weeks ago there, and we've seen the governor take a little bit of a dip in the polls since that debate. So have you seen any sort of change, either in rhetoric or tone or appearance schedule on the road following that debate?
Absolutely, I did, Veronica. One thing that you'll often hear the governor talk about is how he's not going to criticize his fellow Republicans. He's just going to focus on himself and on criticizing Democrats like frontrunner Hillary Clinton. But today, you heard him. He came out in his speech, again in his interviews with reporters, being very critical of the Republican Congress for not repealing Obamacare as they campaigned on, not sending a repeal of Obamacare to the president to be vetoed. Now, part of that is that Walker's going to talk about health care tomorrow in Minneapolis, going to talk about it this week. But another part of that was clearly trying to capitalize on this on these insurgent campaigns from people like Donald Trump and Ben Carson, who are Washington outsiders.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Jason Stein, Capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Coming up, we'll get two perspectives on the debate over whether or not Waukesha should be allowed to use water from Lake Michigan. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out this week. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out this week. Today and tomorrow, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is holding public hearings on a proposal to allow the city of Waukesha to use water from Lake Michigan. Waukesha says it needs a new source of water to address water supply and quality concerns. Its primary source of water is a deep aquifer groundwater supply, but low levels in that aquifer have increased levels of radium, a naturally occurring carcinogen in the groundwater. But the group Compact Implementation Coalition is against Waukesha's Great Lakes Water Diversion Proposal. The coalition says the city's proposal doesn't meet the standards set by the Great Lakes Compact. The Great Lakes Compact is a federally adopted agreement saying the Great Lakes water can never be pumped beyond the borders of counties that straddle the Great Lakes Basin. And we're hearing from both sides of this issue now. Dan Dukniak is with us. He's the general manager of Waukesha Water Utility, and he supports the diversion proposal. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
And we also have George Meyer with us. He's the executive director at the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. He opposes Waukesha's water diversion proposal. George, welcome back to you.
Good afternoon, Victoria, and good afternoon, Dan.
It's Veronica.
Good afternoon, George.
No problem there. And Dan, we're going to start with you. Dan, why do you think the city of Waukesha should be allowed to use water from Lake Michigan?
Well, as you had indicated, the groundwater we rely on is down hundreds of feet, and that's due to a geological feature. It's a thick layer of shale or a thick layer of rock, probably 150 to 250 feet thick, that prevents rain and snowmelt from replenishing the water deep in the aquifer. And there's a lot of people in southeastern Wisconsin, northeastern Illinois that pull water from this aquifer. In fact, the aquifer extends from the Green Bay area all the way through down through northeastern Illinois. And as a result of that drawdown, we've run into natural contaminants like radium, which is a carcinogen. And we are under a court order to provide water that supplies, or a water supply that complies with the federal drinking standard for radium. But radium is not the only issue in the deep aquifer. There's also total dissolved solids, which is like salt in the water or brackish water, that is increasing and getting close to the standards of 500 milligrams per liter of parts per million. And we've also seen well failures and other things that have happened with our deep aquifer wells. And so in 2002, we ventured on a new water supply study that looked at all of our alternatives. It looked at all of the groundwater, surface water, and the Great Lakes alternative. And after 10 years of study and thorough reports and review by our consultant, CH2M Hill, and the water utility, and our regional planning commission also did a 5-year study, and we concluded that the Great Lakes was the only reasonable alternative for the city of Waukesha. It's important to know that the compact does not say it must be a last resort. It says it has to be no reasonable water supply alternative.
And George, we're gonna go to George now just to make sure we get his voice in here as well. George, what problems do you see with this?
Well, as Dan indicated, the application must meet the standards of the Great Lakes Compact, and We believe while it's critically important to provide clean water to the city of Waukesha, that in fact there is a reasonable alternative to this proposal. Part of the problem is it does not meet the standards. And the first standard that it doesn't meet is that it goes beyond the amount of water that, as a community, that they need. In their plan, the city of Waukesha actually increases its service area by 40%, which does not comply with the Great Lakes Compact. And there's good news. One of the alternatives that has not been fully explored by the city has been explored by the nonprofit organizations, and we've hired firms which have, in fact, come up with a non-divergent solution that can, in fact, especially if we stay within the community service area, can meet the water supply needs for the city of Waukesha, treat the radium, and provide sufficient water until 2050.
And, Dan, the DNR has taken a look at this and approved this plan. What have they said?
Well, they've approved, they've agreed with us that our only, after a five-year-long review, they've agreed with us that the only reasonable water supply alternative for the city of Waukesha is the Great Lakes alternative. The DNR has, in fact, met with the coalition. They've had several meetings with them in March and in June of this year and have reviewed their alternative, have looked at lower water demands that pretty much what the group is saying we could do. And they have concluded, and they've also used the modeling that this group has also provided, and they have concluded that there are 700 to 23 acres of wetlands that would be negatively affected. Now, to put that into some perspective for people, that's the equivalent of 550 to 1,800 football fields of wetlands that would be negatively impacted and negatively affected.
And they'd be negatively impacted because of depleting
because of
water?
Because of the drawdown in the aquifers that would be associated with it. So what the DNR has concluded with this alternative and that this group has put forward is that the impact to 700 to 23 acres of wetlands is not necessarily reasonable, and that therefore their alternative is not a reasonable and it's unworkable. So they've agreed with us that the only reasonable alternative is a Great Lakes alternative for the city of Waukesha.
And George, as we just heard, the DNR has approved the plan of the city of Waukesha, and we'll get more into that plan in just a moment, but why aren't you on board with the agency's evaluation of that proposal?
Well, and in fact, Dan referred to a former study and a former alternative that we had put together, and it did show that there would be some wetland impacts. Because of that, we went back to the drawing board. We have a great new engineering study, and in fact, it's on our website, that in fact shows without any impact to other surface waters or wetlands, we can provide the current service area of the city of Waukesha sufficient water for until 2015. And what's good news for the 2050, and what's good news for the ratepayers of the city of Waukesha, it can be done at half the cost. This proposal will be submitted to the DNR in its total detail during this application process. And this plan does meet any legal standards, including the Great Lakes Compact. In fact, what it means is that the city could shorten this whole process and not have to go to the eight other states who could veto their current proposal for not meeting the standards.
Dan, I want to hear a little bit about the details of this plan and how Waukesha would source this water and return it. What are the bare bones that we need to know?
Well, basically we are planning on purchasing water from the city of Oak Creek and piping that water to the city of Waukesha, using that water, and then returning 100%, approximately 100% of that water to the Root River, where it discharges into the Great Lakes. Now, one of the important things to note about the Root River is George was involved in the discussion about going to the Root River. He was one of the main people that kind of steered us towards the Root River, but also the Root, they've been looking at ways to augment flow in the Root River because of the low flows that they have for since the late 50s, early 60s. Only they couldn't afford to do it the state or the city because of the cost associated with it. This is a way for us to accomplish that and augment that flow in the Root River, providing environmental benefits to the Root River with our return flow water and having no net impact on the lakes, being able to use and recycle the water back to the Great Lakes, having, again, like I said, no net impact and providing an environmental benefit, because that additional flow that would be provided to the Root River would allow for the passage of fish to get upstream to the fisheries that the DNR has downstream on the Root River, allowing them to harvest more fish eggs and provide more fishing opportunities. They have estimated that there could be as many as 10,000 additional angling hours provided as a result of the additional flow in the Root River. So this is a win-win for everyone. We're able to use and recycle the water, something we can't do with groundwater. We can't pull water out of the ground and recycle it back into the lake, but we can recycle and reuse the water with the Great Lakes, providing that additional environmental benefit to the Root River and to the people who live downstream and who enjoy the fishing in the Great Lakes.
We're getting two perspectives right now on the proposal to allow the city of Waukesha to source its water from Lake Michigan. We're talking with Dan Duchniak of the Waukesha Water Utility and George Meyer from the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. And George, you disagree about the environmental effects on the Root River. What do you say? What do you see there?
Well, there would be some benefits to a discharge to the Red River. Increasing the flow for fisheries is one of them. It would increase the total loading of phosphorus to the river, but that's sort of at the end of the process. That is one of the four standards that has to be met under it. But the first two, it's really critical. And the reason why we're concerned about any proposal meeting of standards, and I speak for the organization I work for, if in fact this proposal met the standards, we would be very supportive of Waukesha's proposal. But the reason we're in, we have a statewide organization, what we're concerned about is if a proposal gets approved that doesn't meet the standards, that weakens the compact and, in fact, invites court challenges from others outside of our basin saying, hey, they're not enforcing their compact, and get a federal court to throw it out
and
allow water to be taken out of the basin.
George, why do you say it doesn't meet the standards of the compact?
Well, for one, is that they, instead of just solving their current service water area, service area, and solving the needs there, they're expanding into four different other units of government, substantially increasing the amount of area that's going to be served, and which means more water would be taken. That is clearly not in compliance with the standard. Basically, it's really a very tough standard to meet. It's, in fact, to meet an existing problem of a community, not of some other community outside of it. And in fact, the communities outside of it do not need any water and have stated so publicly. They have come out and said, we'll sign a letter for the city of Waukesha. We really don't need to meet this water. Now, that is a glaring problem with the compact. And the second is you have to show there's no reasonable alternative. The alternative we have, which includes treatment on three of the wells, is a reasonable alternative. It's the most cost-effective alternative. And those two areas of the compact standards are not being met by this proposal.
And I want to get to our callers, but Dan, briefly, what do you say to that, that this does not meet the standards of the Great Lakes Compact?
Well, first of all, it's the law that we have to meet the service area. The law says that all water utilities by 2025 will have to have a water supply service area. Again, George was involved in the development of this law, of the statewide law, as was many members of the Compact Implementation Coalition. This was put into place so that we would properly plan for our service area in the future. One of the things the law says is that we cannot restrict the service area to municipal boundaries. We have to provide service to our service area. So we had requested that service area be developed by SewerPAC, which is a Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission, who has planning authority over our region. And they prepared these the water supply service area. It's consistent with our sanitary sewer service area, and it's consistent with other planning documents, and they look at a number of different things. So we were not involved in the development of the service area. Then we went to the additional entities that were in that service area, and we asked them, do you want to be included or not? They have all passed resolutions saying that they do want to be included into this. When George says that they do not have a need, I disagree with that. You know, the town of Waukesha, just south of us, has molybdenum in their water from landfill contamination. There's arsenic in the water that we've identified. They have had failing septic systems that have contaminated private wells that we've had to provide service for homeowners because of that. So there are a number of different reasons why they need the water in the town of Waukesha.
We're getting two perspectives right now on the proposal to allow the city of Waukesha to source its water from Lake Michigan. We're talking with Dan Dukniak of the Waukesha Water Utility and George Meyer from the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. And we're taking your calls. What do you think about the idea of allowing Waukesha to source its water from Lake Michigan? How could something like this maybe affect your community? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now about the proposal to allow the city of Waukesha to source its water from Lake Michigan. We have two guests with us from opposing views. Dan Dukniak is general manager of the Waukesha Water Utility. He supports the proposal. And we're also talking to George Meyer, executive director at the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. George is against the idea of letting Waukesha use Great Lakes water. And we go to our callers now. We've got Jake joining us from Milwaukee. Jake, hi.
Yeah, ever since this has been proposed that Waukesha has to get a new water supply because they polluted their own aquifer. City of Waukesha, town of Waukesha, has done nothing that I know of for water conservation, not even a simple raising of rates, plans to help recharge the aquifer, zoning issues, and other things that could, you know, help with this. They've just been waiting on Lake Michigan water. And to me, I used to live out in Waukesha. I live in Milwaukee. I think it's irresponsible, and they do not deserve Lake Michigan water because there's no, in my mind, that they'll be good stewards of that water either.
Jake, thank you so much for your call. And Dan, we're going to let you respond to that. What about conservation? Has Waukesha done enough to conserve its water before moving to source from Lake Michigan?
First off, excellent question by Jake, and I just want to really quickly point out that it's only parts of four other communities. It's not all of these four other communities. I was kind of cut off a little bit before, but the town of Waukesha has passed a resolution because of it and that they have a need for water. The town of Genesee was added at the request of the DNR, not at our request. It was at the request of the DNR. Mm-hmm. The city of Pewaukee is only because of a border agreement that we had with them that's been in place for a long time, and the town of Delafield is only the pieces that are in our sanitary sewer service area. So it is very limited what the other areas are. But with regards to conservation, anyone that gets on Great Lakes water from our municipality will have to meet the aggressive conservation program that we have in place for the city of Waukesha. We have done a lot. We are the first utility in the state to have inclining rates. We have a toilet rebate program. We have a ban on sprinkling during the hours of 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. and we limit people to 2 days a week. And so they would have to meet our aggressive conservation standards. But also with regards to the drawdown in the deep aquifer, you know, this isn't only Waukesha that contributed to that drawdown in the deep aquifer. As I mentioned, this is more of a regional issue. The city of Milwaukee was actually responsible for probably about half of the drawdown because they were on groundwater before they switched to Great Lakes water in the 50s. And when you look at the drawdown and how that was impacted throughout the aquifer, that drawdown, about more than half of it was associated to the use in the city of Milwaukee. And then as Milwaukee shifted, it shifted out to Waukesha when we were on the deep aquifer water. So there is some responsibility for the others in the region for this drawdown in the aquifer. It's not just Waukesha's issue.
And Jake, thank you so much for the call. We're going to go next to David in Wanakee. David, hi.
Hi. My question, when you were initially talking about this and brought up the concept of you have to show a need, was the statements that the need is based a lot on artificial contamination of a lot of the water sources that are currently available. Is there any requirement at all to clean up that water or do any sort of work on that rather than just say, let's just go find another water source?
David, thank you. And let's go to George this time. What do you think about that question, George?
Well, in this situation, the pollution that's in the water is not man-made. It is it's radium. It's naturally in the rock. And because of the historic drawdown of the water, it allowed the water to get down to a stage where you started getting oxygen working on the rock down there, which released the radium to the water. And this is very common. There's many other communities, about 40 other communities in the state that have this problem. The good news, one of the good news is that it's very treatable. These other communities in the state treat it without going to Great Lakes water. And in fact, the one good news that Dan didn't point out is the drawdown aquifer of the aquifer has reversed, is starting to reverse itself. And in fact, in the last 15 years, the water has risen in that aquifer between 60 to 100 feet. And that's because a lot of that use that he referred to, which is true, that much of it came from, you know, the larger breweries in Milwaukee and some of the industrial base there. Mm-hmm. You know, those needs aren't there anymore.
And we have to leave it there. I'm afraid we're out of time. Dan and George, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dan Dukniak, General Manager of Waukesha Water Utility. We also heard from George Meyer, Executive Director at the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. Two opposing views there on the proposal to allow the city of Waukesha to source its water from Lake Michigan. The DNR is holding hearings on this proposal tonight and tomorrow, and the public comment period runs through August 28th. You can find more information about those hearings on the Central Time Facebook page. Nobody probably wants to be thinking about winter yet, unless you're really sick of the hot weather that hit us this last weekend. But this is Wisconsin, and so it never hurts to be prepared. According to the Old Farmer's Almanac, which is coming out next week, the coming winter is supposed to be unusually cold, with heaps of snow, even in places that don't usually get it. And as for the Midwest, we're expected here to have especially frigid temperatures. Surprise there. Well, just about everybody who gets snow will have a white Christmas in one capacity or another. That from a spokesperson for the almanac. But keep in mind, the Old Farmer's Almanac is 224 years old, and it uses a forecasting model based on a secret formula that founder Robert B. Thomas designed using solar cycles, climatology, and meteorology. And a lot of meteorologists dismiss it as unscientific. Still, probably a great time of year to get a discount on extra shovels and space heaters. And at the very least, it's a reminder to enjoy what's left of summer.